I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. It's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. Have we romanticized summer? Is the very notion of a magical summer more myth than reality? For example, most experts agree that camps are good for kids. Camps that focus on art, music, computers, and math provide an opportunity to learn new things and maintain skills during the summer learning lull. But camps are pricey, and that means that kids from low-income families are often susceptible to the dreaded summer slide. Shireen at Christmas joins us. She's the executive director of Muse 360 Arts. Next month, she's taking a group of city youth scholars to Ghana to study African history. A conversation about kids, class, and camp. That's coming up when Midday gets underway, right after these headlines.
Roll out those lazy, hazy, crazy days of summer. Those days of soda and pretzels and beer. Roll out. Stop the sun and moon and sing a song of cheer.
Ah, yes, those lazy, hazy, crazy days of summer. Nat King Cole, boy, that guy could sing. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday, the 1963 summer classic, adopted from a German pop song composed a year earlier. Of course, for many kids today, summer days are anything but lazy. Many kids spend their summers just as programmed and as scheduled as they are during the school year. Computer camp, music camp, soccer camp, day camp, sleepaway camp. The summer camp industry is huge. The American Camp Association estimates revenue in excess of $18 billion a year, with more than 14 million kids under the care of more than 1.5 million camp staffers nationwide. But not every child has the option of an organized and engaging summer camp experience. For many kids in low-income communities, summer is a time of stress, isolation, and idleness. Today on Midday, it's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. She's the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at the Maryland Institute College of Art. So is there a certain mythology about summer camp and our notions of what an American summer is all about? What were your experiences as a child, and what experiences do you seek out for your children? You can join us at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday at WIPR.org. You can drop us a tweet at midday WIPR, and we are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. We'd love to hear your experiences at camp, those great ones, those terrifying ones, those traumatizing ones, your feelings about what you think your kids should be doing at summer camp this summer. Happy summer, Sherry. It's good to see you.
Happy summer to you, too.
So were you a camper when you were a kid?
Yes and no. You know, I had a traumatic experience, which I'll tell you about. But it involved a family of skunks outside.
Let's start with that. What better way to start than talking about skunks?
Well, this was a...
You grew up in North Carolina, right?
I grew up in Western North Carolina, mm-hmm. where camping has been an industry for a long time. And this was... YWCA teen sleepaway camp, and you know we'll talk about this aesthetic of roughing it. So this was a three-walled cabin with a tarp for when it rained on the side, with middle school girls inside, which is really probably the source of trauma.
But forget the skunks. Skunks are the least of your problems.
There was a family of skunks right outside, and when I reported it, they said yes. And so basically, we were very quiet, and I think that's what they meant. But it was a week long of, you know, tiptoeing around this whole family of skunks. And you know about mama animals and how protective they are. They're young. So I managed.
Actually, I don't. I don't know anything about nature. I mean, as my dad used to say, my idea of roughing it is sleeping in a Holiday Inn with the windows open. You know, I mean, I have never been in the proximity of a family of skunks that I know of.
Well, let's just put it this way. We learned, you know, about tomato juice and all of those things that you use when skunks spray you.
So the deal was, could you actually be quiet enough and tiptoe around them enough so that they would either not know you were there or not be
threatened enough to spray us. I actually didn't get sprayed. So some of us succeeded, but some of us did not.
Now, do skunks actually spray individual human beings, or do they just spray in general?
Oh, they can aim it at you, wow. Evidently, or maybe one was particularly talented. But the important part here is that in the face of roughing it, they didn't bother. They didn't remove the irritant.
Right.
They expected us to figure it out. And that's a really important thread that runs particularly through the earlier years of American camping.
Yeah. And this whole notion of sending kids to camp, it grew out of the desire to get boys in particular out of urban areas, right? And this is, of course, white boys in the turn of the century, late 1800s, beginning of the 1900s, get them out of the urban environments that they were, steeped in to get them ruralized in some way, which is going to make men out of them or something.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because, I think there are two really important cultural assumptions there. We still actually pay a lot of adherence to that pastoral myth of, America as the land of, the waving plains and of wheat and all of that. And the idea that cities were these artificial constructions, which, in many ways they are, and that particularly cities were a threat to masculinity. So you had to send the white boys to the country so that they wouldn't be too feminine.
Yeah.
The article that we were referring to didn't say that, but that's
Really the History Channel had an article and they were worried about them being feminized or sissified. Because if they're in school all the time, the schools, of course, were run by women.
Mm-hmm.
So they had all this interaction with women and those things feminine. And they wanted to get them in the summer. They wanted to get them out and do rough and tumble things.
Right. And that's why, you're not going to the Holiday Inn or not going to the Holiday Inn. That's where that roughing it, because you think about it, that doesn't necessarily have to be there. And of course, they do adopt their perception of what indigenous culture was about. There's lots of, cultural appropriation that's going on there. And what's really important.
Right, all this, I'm saying these kids are going to become like, mini Native Americans.
Right, exactly. Which, runs counter to exactly what they were supposed to be doing the rest of the year, right? But at the base of all of this is our conceptualization of childhood. And these are so much in our bones, including my bones, that sometimes we don't question it. I mean, what is childhood supposed to be like? It's supposed to be this time of fun and leisure. And I'm not arguing against it. I'm just identifying this time of leisure. And if they work too hard in school, then we have to create an antidote to that by giving them leisure and fun. And of course, summer isn't much like that anymore for children.
Well, no time is like that for children. Mm. Children now just seem to be programmed as can be. I mean, my child is 30 years old, so it's been a long time since I've been in the carpool lines for these various activities, but she had them piled higher and deeper as a kid growing up.
Oh,
your daughter was, she's an equestrian. She was big on horses and stuff like
and,
that.
And you don't even know about the violin and the theater camp. And I mean, basically, in January, as a middle-class parent, you start perusing the different camps. And we found some statistics that the average family spends about $1,000 a summer on camp. Now, obviously, some of that is child care, but it optimally is not just child care. And there's this other perception that, and I'm not sure that this is wrong, that a few weeks in the summer can change a life.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is, just on the math of it, is a very interesting assumption.
And for little kids, some of it is the challenge and overcoming the barrier of going to sleepaway camp, for example, because if you can stay away from home for a week and then the next summer it's 2 weeks, and by the time you're in high school, it's like sometimes 6 and 8 weeks. People disappear for summer camps at a certain economic strata because those things are really expensive.
Mm-hmm.
But they disappear for entire, months at a time. And that's, all about getting your independence or something. I don't know what it's about.
Yeah, there is an interesting kind of weaning that is inconsistent in the way we were just talking about with the rest of the year. Although, some parents obviously do send their kids to boarding school, but many more send their children to sleepaway camp. And, of course, the first year is traumatic, always. Yeah, because and you do all these things, letters and all those things. But the idea that this child needs to be weaned away from you is an important concept. Now, we have to always...
And if so, at what age is the right age for that to start?
Right.
You know, I mean, you're going to get weaned at 18 if you go to college, or you're going to get weaned at 24 if you, you
go
know,
to grad school.
Go to grad school. I don't know. You know, but yeah, but you know, what? When is there is age 6 or age 9 or age 11 the best time to start weaning? I have no idea.
Well, and you know, let's be clear. I haven't seen this study, but I know many, many families for whom. Let's back up and say childhood is defined by adults. I mean, children don't define childhood. And for many parents, that summer is for them. It's like, get these kids away so I can do the things I want to do.
Dr. Sherry Parks is here. It's Midday Culture Connections. I'm Tom Hall. Our number 410-662-8780. What was your experience as a camper, as a kid, if you were one of those? Or what was your experience if you never went to camp and you just hung around? Did you do organized activities, or were your activities really basically up to you? Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And we're streaming on the WYPR Facebook page as well. So, what about the argument, which is runs counter to the current argument that we have, that people are very much worried about academic problems originating from the fact that, you know, kids are out of school for 10 or 11 weeks straight. So people worry about the summer slide. What about the other side of that argument, which says that all of these organized activities are also, they also have a downside, that a little indolence, a little hanging around, a little unprogrammed time as a child isn't a bad thing?
Well, it's interesting because we were just talking about weaning children, and there's a different type of summer independence that those of us of a certain age will remember, where you open the door after breakfast in the morning and you got on your bike and you only had to come back when the streetlights came on, in my case. And you ran in and out of the house or other houses all day long and eating and doing things like that. But that type of independence is not one that many children in urban or even rural situations know anymore because of fears of safety. And I do remember that there was a moment where, because I even though I grew up in Asheville, North Carolina at the time, the neighborhood was still heavily wooded. And I remember some moments that were a little scary, but they weren't treated, and I'm not suggesting this, but they weren't treated in quite the same way. My mother didn't keep me off the bicycle because there was a guy in the woods once. And so how we think about childhood independence and dependence is interesting. And it seems that when I go back to say this is designed by adults, it has more to do with our perceptions as adults than it is what the children want. Because that delicious freedom just to plan your own day, and actually it has some cognitive implications, which you just pointed to. The ability to entertain yourself.
Yeah.
The ability to just imagine something. One summer I started, it was my first journalistic endeavor. I had asked for a toy printing press, and I started a neighborhood newspaper. It was my first experience with censorship because I was a little too observant.
And how old were you?
I was about 8, mm-hmm. And there was a woman down the street who was obviously having an affair, and I reported on the comings and goings. of what was obviously later her lover, and my mother showed
the
me.
Liz Smith of yes. Asheville, North Carolina.
Well, I just
gentlemen.
Said it was very nice, and I knew his name because he was the husband of my first grade teacher, that he came for lunch every day. I just thought that was very nice. I didn't know what I was doing, but my mother quickly shut me down.
Put that printing press brag back in the closet.
Yeah. I mean, but notice how different that is from journalism camp. Where yeah. it's run by adults.
And the whole notion that it's not up to your mom or your dad to entertain you.
Right?
Mom on board. That's your problem. I got bigger fish to fry at the moment. Like, literally, I'm putting dinner together for, you know, the 7 people in our family. Did you grow up in a large family?
No, there were 3 kids.
Yeah.
So
there were 5 in mine, and we never went to camp. It was just never an option. I don't know if that was financial. I'm sure that was part of it. But we lived in the suburbs. I never lived in a city until I, you know, went to college. And I haven't lived in anywhere other than cities since college. So I don't know what that says to me, but it says about my upbringing and whether or not I was, you know, I did not become a fan of suburban life. I want to live downtown.
Well, part of the time, my mother, she was a school teacher, and this summer she ran a day camp that I often went to.
Mm-hmm.
And And thinking about the show has reminded me that when my mom passed, one of the things I did in her memory was I paid for a girl. I said, it just has to be a girl.
To go to a camp.
Notice all of the assumptions that are based in that I said it needs to be a family that's really trying, to better themselves. And camp, in my mind, and I'm not disagreeing with myself, was a tool in that progression.
It was about betterment.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, uplift.
Uplift and betterment. Yeah. As well as safety, as well as the supervision. Well, as all as
and the mom agreed with me. She wrote me a very nice letter.
Dr. Sherry Parks joins me here in Studio A. We'll have more Midday Culture Connections when we return after a quick break. Got a couple of phone calls that we're going to try to get to when we come back. By the way, before we go to a quick break, a word about a loss to the arts community of a wonderful guy. Van Reiner died last week. He's a former executive at Bethlehem Steel, and then he served for 13 years as the president and CEO of the Maryland Science Center. He retired in 2017. Van was warm, erudite, dedicated, and gracious, and his leadership of the Science Center was exemplary. Van Reiner was 70 years old. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back.
This is 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, A History and Defense of Liberalism, with New Yorker columnist and best-selling author Adam Gopnik. Since 1994, the number of Democrats that identify as liberals has swelled from 25% to 51%. A new generation of young, liberal-leaning voters will take to the polls in 2020, and their impact on the future of American politics could be critical. Just as Trumpism has transformed conservatism, what does it mean to be a liberal in this day and age? In his new book, 1,000 Small Sanities, Adam Gopnik avers that liberalism is one of the great moral adventures in human history. Adam Gopnik joins me for the hour tomorrow here on Midday. If you're just joining us today, we're talking about the American summer idyll and how summertime activities can provide opportunities that spark new interest and awaken talents in kids that can be transformative. And how do we address the challenge of making those opportunities available to kids in low-income neighborhoods? You are welcome to be part of our conversation at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. To drop us a tweet, it's @MiddayWYPR. You can follow me on Twitter @TomHallWYPR, and you can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. Sherry Parks, before we go to the phones, you're an educator. You're the mother of a very well-educated young woman. What's your take on the so-called summer slide? We had this come up just this last session, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, I guess, in 2016, Governor Hogan, by executive order, declared that school shall not start before Labor Day, and it shall not continue continue after June 15th. And he just decided that for every jurisdiction in Maryland. The legislature in this past session overruled that. They overrode a veto of a law concerning that. So now individual jurisdictions will decide whether they start a little earlier, or they start a little later, et cetera. In terms of kids being out of school for X number of weeks a summer, is there a deleterious result?
Well, there seems to be for children whose families are less affluent than middle class, because, of course, the middle class families are programming their summers with all kinds of enrichment camps, so they jump ahead. But children who are not in some sort of summer enrichment then lose 2 months a year, and the sad part is they don't catch up. And so by the time they graduate from high school, they may be 3 years behind because of that. Many other post-industrial societies have shorter vacations. They have more of them and shorter, and they're not experiencing this. So this is a particularly American experience. They have this long 3-month summer and the slide that happens.
Yeah, I know. In England, Germany, I think the summer vacations, such as they are, about 6 weeks, and they have the other intervals mm-hmm. during the spaced out during the year. But here in America, it's long been, and I was always under the impression that was an agrarian calendar-based thing. The kids needed to get out of school in late spring, early summer to work in the fields, and then once things were planted in September, they could go back to school.
Well, I think that is part of it. That also, in some ways, is where spring break happens, and when it happens in different parts of the country is when you're planting, and then you go back and you work the fields. And so, again, notice that that wasn't for the benefit of the children, although they ate the food. That's really an adult saying, I need you back to work the fields.
I happen to find myself, Linnell and I were together. We did take a few days off in South Beach, Miami, during spring break. It was March of, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. There was very little agrarian concentration at that juncture, as I recall.
It is very much a holdover from a different time.
Let's go to the phones to Thomas in Montgomery County. Thomas, welcome to Midday with Dr. Sherry Parks.
Hey, thanks for having me on, and thanks for doing this segment. I grew up going to camp, one camp in particular, and actually work there now on and off for the last 6-7 summers, I guess. So it's a very sort of intense kind of outdoor camp, being in Montgomery County. And I think the nature of sort of outdoor sport activities, we struggle a lot to have a diverse population at camp. We offer scholarships, and we try to really publicize that. But it appears that my thought is that perhaps there's sort of a cultural gap there. Right. So if you don't have one generation or peers that are going to camp, particularly outdoor activities, you might have trouble with sort of one kid or one family trying to take this risk. I think it's really crucial at my camp. I work with younger kids where I kind of cover myself in mud and we scream and we try to sort of disrupt this helicopter mom culture that so many of them are immersed in. I'm a working artist now, and I wouldn't be that if I didn't have freedom to play during the summers.
All right. Thanks, Thomas. I appreciate that. Freedom to play. That we do hear that about kids now. You know, they're just not ever unprogrammed. They're never unscheduled. It's play dates. You know, even when they're little, they are not told to just go play. They are brought to some other kid's house and said, now, enjoy yourself.
Right. And we know that imagination actually leads to what we call intelligence in the adult. And so we have to worry about what happens next.
As we mentioned, it's about $1,000 per child to send your kid to a moderately priced camp. That's out of the price range of an awful lot of people.
I'd say in Baltimore, it's a bit more.
Yeah. And there's a piece in the New York Times a couple of years ago talking about families from all over the country who just simply couldn't swing that. I mean, are there efforts to make those opportunities available? I mean, is there enough evidence, enough feeling, enough data that says, look, these experiences really are good, particularly for kids who live in the city, who spend their the other 10 months of the year in the city? Is it a really good, one would assume, just sort of viscerally, you would think it's a really good idea to get out of town and do something different?
Well, I mean, it's not out of town, but I think that's where 12-month Head Start comes from, is to keep kids active and intellectually engaged until then. It's mixed. I was thinking about his example, and I think if you come from working class people, that a week in the woods pretending that you're rural poor may not be so attractive.
But are you pretending that you're rural poor, or are you just pretending that you're rural? I mean, if you're out there with the chickens and the goats and whoever else
in
is
a
in
three-sided
the woods,
cabin with a tarp on the side.
Yeah.
I mean, think about
it. Because there is this notion that they sort of try to mythologize what rural living is, or what forest living is, or whatever you call it.
And he mentioned diversity, and I know that some of the Girl Scout data about particularly African-American girls is that caring for your child, you're assuming that your child can take care of her hair while camping, is something that mothers and girls actually worry about.
Mm. I have a lot of things I worry about. That has never been one of them, interestingly enough. Let's go to the phone.
Well, there's a reason for that.
Yeah, there is a reason for that. You've seen my haircut. You know there's a real good reason for that. Don in Bel Air is on the phone. Don, welcome to Midday with Dr. Sherry Parks.
Hey, good afternoon. When I was a kid, I grew early and fast, so naturally they put a basketball in my hand.
You were a tall kid, huh?
I was about in fifth grade till going into my senior year in high school. I used to go to basketball camp every year. I got to know some really great kids from very diverse backgrounds. You know, locker rooms have been some of the most diversified places on the planet for a long, long time. Not only that, but I got coached by guys who were in the NBA. Willis Reed taught me how to shoot a hook shot. Bill Bradley taught me how to shoot a jumper. Bob Knight was my coach one summer. Louis Carnesecca, Pete Carroll. These are all guys that were in the Hall of Fame. So it was a really, really great experience all the way around. And, camp is invaluable in my eyes.
Do you have kids yourself, Don?
No, I'm afraid I don't.
Yeah, but for you, this is something that has left an indelible mark, certainly.
I've got friends to this day that I made on basketball courts when I was a kid.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks so much. And, of course, Don is one of those kids who was evidently really good at basketball. That's why he's going to basketball camps with Willis Reed and Bill Bradley, teaching it. So for the kids who are really good at art, the kids who are really good at programming, the kids who are really good at, all these different specialties, they have a particularly good time at these places that really challenge them.
Well, and, he makes a point that it depends on the camp, that basketball would draw a more diverse group of people than violin camp, where my daughter was the only African-American kid in violin camp. So, I think it changes based on what we're talking about. But notice he's telling a story that camp did change his life, that a few months in the summer did change his life.
Let's go back to the phones to John in Highlandtown. John, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Tom. Good afternoon, Dr. Parks.
Hi.
How are you? I really enjoy the show, and I especially enjoy when Dr. Parks is on.
Me too.
Good. The reason I called is, I heard your show, and I was like, I grew up back in 1973, 1974, those summers, I was 9 and 10 years old, and my father and my brother and sister and I spent the summers at a Mennonite farm in Lancaster County, a little bit south of the town of Lancaster, and it was a chicken farm owned by the McMichael family. And there was an adjacent dairy farm that was a McMichael cousin that owned. And so we'd spend time working on both farms. We'd collect the eggs twice a day, worked on the farm, pulling weeds and collecting various different things in the garden. The meals always included something from the farm, something that, either the eggs for breakfast or rhubarb, which I wouldn't touch at that age. Pretty much any vegetables and things that were grown on the farm. It was a Mennonite farm. It was organic as well. And the Mennonite religion played a big part in everything that went on the farm. We'd go to church services with them. And there was a church-run recreation center that had called The Barn, where it was the first place in my life I ever played volleyball and always felt included, even though I was much smaller.
And how did the camp experience compare to your regular living experience? Did you live in a city and then go out to the country, or did you live in a suburban or a rural environment to begin with?
I grew up down in Linthicum, and I was lucky enough that our father was a school teacher, and so he got the summers off. He taught at Brooklyn Park High School. And so he found out about this farm. There used to be a organic shop down in Glen Burnie called the Nature's Cupboard of Love. And the owner told us, connected us with the farmer where he got his eggs. And that's how we found out about them. And it was my brother, who I guess was like 15 or 16, who initiated the whole thing, said that he wanted to work on a farm. And, got up early in the morning, you worked all day. But it was a really neat experience, and it's something I always come back to.
Did you say you met your wife at camp?
No. I actually met my wife playing volleyball
here
in Baltimore.
Okay. I thought you mentioned her at camp.
Yeah. Well, thanks for that call, John. I appreciate it. We have an email from Katie who says, one highlight of our past three summers has been serving as a host family for the Fresh Air Fund. Mm. Fresh Air Fund has been in existence since 1877 with the mission of helping low-income children in New York to experience life outside of the city. So our Fresh Air Fund guest, Sean, was six when he started visiting us for a week or 2 weeks every summer. He was shocked at how dark our nights were and thrilled with the freedom of being able to run right out on the driveway and shoot baskets. So fresh air fun is something you see about in the New York Times all the time. And the kids go to not just places in New York. They go to places all around. And I assume Katie is from here in Maryland somewhere. I don't know that. But that's a great idea. Of course, the Y of Central Maryland has programs where you can contribute financially to subsidize or support children who go to the Y summer camps. They have, I guess, a sort of a sliding scale. They assess a person's income and needs for the tuition to the camp, and then offer scholarships accordingly. So that's an opportunity. And in just a few minutes, we're going to talk to a woman named Sharena Christmas, who has a wonderful group called Muse 360 Arts. They're sending some kids to Ghana. There are ways of supporting that. So there are opportunities to make these experiences possible.
And, you know, you mentioned 1877. That's exactly that period that we were talking about, where they felt they needed to get kids out of the city for their well-being. And again, that's not something I disagree with, but it's important to note how different their day-to-day lives are during the year versus
the summer. Fresh air fun. I mean, the assumption is that if you're living in Brooklyn or Queens or Lower Manhattan, the air wasn't all that fresh in the summer. And it's interesting how, you know, so many people who live in Manhattan, for example, or live in, L.A., they escape the city for the summer. You know, the rich people go to the Hamptons and, you know, Fire Island and all that kind of stuff. And less affluent people look for things to do on the weekends outside of town.
That would be the Jersey Shore.
The Jersey Shore, exactly. The Situation. Remember him from the Jersey Shore?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, of course you do. Who of us could possibly forget The Situation? Frank in Baltimore. Frank, welcome to Midday with Dr. Sherry Parks.
Thank you, Tom. Dr. Park, you mentioned that your mom was a school teacher. I'm the son of a school teacher. My dad was a bus driver. Grew up in West Baltimore, and we would get up in the morning and go out to play, but we'd have to be back by lunchtime, and then my mom would keep us in out of the heat of the day because we were living in that part of the city, no trees, no shade, concrete and asphalt, and she would give us schoolwork to do. And then there was a period of reading for pleasure, and then a nap, and then we could go back outside until supper time. And then, as you say, when the street lights came on, we were back in and in for the night. And so there is that area of parental participation. I have to say that my parents moved to Ashburton when I was 13, and from that point forward, I worked during the summers. I got my work permit at 14, but in 13, now that I was living in a neighborhood where people had lawns, I was cutting grass just about every day.
Sure.
And then after that, I was working at the school that I went to, and then on the weekends, I was cutting grass in the neighborhood. But the parents, when they can, and I understand, you know, parents working two or three jobs, but as I said, both my parents worked. But they took an active interest in how can we keep our kids on track during the summer.
And that's an important point because, I mean, we saw some statistics that there are, first we should say only a fraction of American children go to camp. I was doing the math because you said 14 million go to camp and there's 74 million kids. Let's shave off the ones that are too little. But you're talking about maybe a fifth or a sixth of American kids who go to camp. And we know that there are some statistics about what the rest of them are doing. And a lot of them are sitting at home for safety reasons in front of the TV for hours and hours and hours. And so camp is an advantage, but lack of camp doesn't have to be as much of a disadvantage if parents think about that time differently.
Let's take a break. We're going to have Sharena Christmas join us in a little bit, and she'll talk about the program that she runs in Ghana, and we'll take some more calls and talk more about what folks are doing during the summers. Dr. Sherry Parks is the Vice President of Strategic Initiatives at the Maryland Institute College of Art. She joins me on the first Tuesday of the month for Midday Culture Connections. Her book is called Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. Coming up after the break, as I mentioned, Sharena Christmas will join us to talk about this program she has. This summer, they're taking some kids to Ghana. We'll hear about that. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. Stick around.
Sue's out for summer.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday Culture Connections. I'm Tom Hall. I'm here in the studio with Dr. Sherry Parks of the Maryland Institute College of Art. If you're just joining us, we're talking about what makes summer special. Do camps, classes, and trips provide children with a leg up? For many poor kids, the opportunities and promise of summer are often out of reach. But one group of Baltimore City youth will have the opportunity to learn and explore way beyond the borders of the city. Joining us now is Sharaina Christmas. She's the executive director of Muse 360 Arts and New Generation Scholars. It's a program that provides city youth the opportunity to travel abroad and study the history and culture of the African diaspora. It's good to see you, Sharaina. Welcome back.
Good to see you too, Tom and Sherry.
Hi there.
Hey.
And to join us to talk about your camp experiences, to talk about your notions of what a magical summer means, 410-662-8780, our email midday at WIPR.org, our Twitter handle at midday WIPR, and we're streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. We've got a bunch of calls to get to, and we'll try to get to them as soon as we can. But Sharaina, this program of New Generation Scholars,
yes.
You have taken children, taken groups of kids to all sorts of places,
yes.
To explore. Tell us about it.
So New Generation Scholars, I founded in 2007 under Muse 360. So it was an opportunity for me to really kind of extend past performing arts and work with youth to really study the African diaspora. So we started out going to New York, and then now this is our 12th year. So we'll be going to Ghana, which is our 10th country. But we've been to places like Cuba, London and Paris. We visited Limon, Costa Rica. We've been to Louisa, Puerto Rico. So we typically go to the areas where people of the diaspora live. And actually are able to preserve their culture. And it's just been an amazing experience. We have scholars now that are graduating from college. We have a scholar that's going to UCLA on a full scholarship based on his experiences. And he wrote a great essay about his experiences traveling and New Generation Scholars. So I'm just grateful. And honestly, that's more than I can ask for in terms of an outcome for my experience working with them. And they teach me a lot, too. Through this process.
And the age range of the kids you take is what?
So now it's 13 to 21. And so it's expanded because at first it started out as 10 to 18, but then my scholars started getting older. And then the curriculum actually started to become a little bit more intense because the scholars have to create a multidisciplinary project in the summer. So they can't just like travel. They also have to create a multidisciplinary project based on the African diaspora. And, you know, my scholars that are in college are saying, hey, Miss Christmas, can I come back for the summer and be a scholar intern? So that's just like another level of a scholar where they have to do a little bit more leadership. And so essentially New Generation Scholars is a leadership program using history at the helm of what we do and how we move through the arts and how we move through life. So
it's not just a, come on, kids, let's go on a trip.
Oh, definitely not.
You
have
to
do a lot of
There's
work.
A whole other educational
yes.
component. So talk about some of the things
yeah.
that they
so
do.
So this year, we actually started in October, and we started with creative labs on Thursdays and leadership labs on Saturdays. And so the requirement is that they do a creative lab in photography to learn how to do photojournalism. And then on Saturdays, they focus on the African diasporic portion of it, which is the history. So we had Dr. Jessica Johnson, who teaches at Hopkins, do the African diasporic part. And then we had Kyle Pompey help us with photography. We had Lisa Stoudt-McCray help us with creative writing, and then I kind of came in and brought it all together. So their first part of this program, which is called SEEK, is the research part, and then they get into the pursue part, which is the photojournalism. So they had to do an oral history project to document the history of Baltimore from an elder and a peer. And then in the summertime, that's become, which is the become phase, which means that they'll actually take all that they've learned, travel, so on and so forth, and create their own project, their own individual project. So they got to do a lot of work.
Yeah. And Cherry Parks, I mean, just getting out of town. I mean, if you grew up in Baltimore and haven't been to a whole lot of places, to get out of town, number one, and to get that far out of town, I mean, to have
that's
that
far.
Kind of incredible cultural change, I mean, it's just life changing.
Well, because you don't know that there's anything different until you see something different. Mm-hmm. And we were talking earlier about the idea that a few weeks during the summer could change a life. And I think you've got a lot of those stories. Mm-hmm. Do you see change incrementally over the years since you're working
oh, yeah.
with the same group
uh-huh.
you know, for a chunk of their lives?
Yeah.
How does that work?
So one of my scholars who actually just graduated from Hampton, I'm very proud, Samora Moore, she started with us at 10. And so she's with us between 10 to 18. And so when I talked about the multidisciplinary...
So she took a bunch of trips then.
Oh, yeah, she took all the trips. Mm-hmm. And she's going to Ghana also. So one of the things that I noticed with her, she started out as a dancer, but she wanted to explore every year like how she could use her dance. And she had a lot of trouble. She was going through some personal challenges. And I'd say really it took until her sixth or seventh year to really kind of grasp the idea of creating a project that would really help her self-identify. So one of the things, she's from East Baltimore, and so one of the things she did was compare, when we went to London and Paris, she compared the displacement of people in Zimbabwe to the displacement of people by Johns Hopkins, like the East Baltimore area. And she used dance through that, and she used shadow lighting. And I mean, and honestly, I didn't help her at all this time. But through the years, it was like pulling teeth to try to get her to just create a basic project, like a poem, you know? And so with that, then seeing her going to Hampton University, getting a scholarship based on her experiences, you know, being, you know, head of the leadership council at Hampton University. Now she's getting her MBA. Next year, you know, all of these things. And they also created from that project, from New Generation Scholars, they created the creative entrepreneurship program, Spark of Genius, to raise money to travel. So all of those experiences I see in Samora, and I just saw her last week and I was crying because I'm like, wow, look at the young lady that you've become. I'm getting chills thinking about it.
Yeah.
Because at 10, didn't see that necessarily. She didn't see that for herself. But by me working with her and the importance of me working with her past just for 6 weeks or, you know, just with dance classes, which so incremental and so instrumental in even her parents helping her to become the woman that she is. And so that's why it's really important that youth development goes way beyond just like, you know, camps, or goes way beyond just going into a program for 4 weeks. You really have to put a lot into it, and you'll see the results. It just may take some years.
You've said twice now about that there are two students who got into either got scholarships or got into college,
yeah,
quote, based on their experiences.
Yeah,
tell me what you mean.
Wild.
So they were like writing essays.
They wrote
about
essays.
Their...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So for example, the young man Justin, he moved to L.A. Justin Scott, and he moved to L.A. his sophomore year, and so he still came back in the summer because he's from here. But he called me and he said, you know, Aunt Sharena, you know, I want to write about my experience in New Generation Scholars for this, you know, piece that I have to do for my UCLA program, because he was like in the pre-collegiate program. And when he did it, a lot of times, you know, when they were looking at some of the content, they're like, did you really travel to these places? Did you, you know, because he started traveling with us when he was 10. And so finally he said, you know, this is really where my heart is. I want to go here, and I'm going to, you know, write my essay to get into, to get a scholarship, because I'm going to be able to get into the school. And so he wrote his essay based on his experience in London, really identifying as a Black man abroad. I mean, he was only like 16 at the time. But yeah, he wrote that. And it was actually kind of coupled with Black masculinity, mm-hmm, and also looking at his relationship with his father. And he sent it to me, and it was really, really touching. But yeah, he used that as his scholarship letter, his scholarship essay to get into UCLA.
Which means, of course, that the colleges are saying, yes, this changed her life, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the colleges are saying this is the kind of experience that, right, we want our community to have. They,
right,
they want kids who are bringing that worldview to UCLA or Hampton or whatever the college is. That's great. Sharena Christmas is the executive director of Muse 360 Arts. Sherry Parks is the vice president of strategic initiatives at Maryland Institute College of Art. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. We'll try to get to a few more phone calls to Wendy in Baltimore. Wendy, welcome to Midday.
Hello, and thank you. I run a nonprofit called Middle Grades Partnership. We started as a way to prevent summer learning loss and actually see summer learning gains in public school students by partnering public and private schools in Baltimore and bringing students and teachers from the public school to the private school setting for the summer, and we've grown quite a bit. We serve 500 students in 8 partnerships across Baltimore between public and private schools. And one of the unique things that we do is we bring together and educate side by side both public and private school students. And the programs are designed by teachers from both the public and private schools to meet broad goals that Middle Grades Partnership develops, and we also have a year-round program that works where students work together on leadership and civic leadership, contributing back to the city. Our kids stay for 3 years, and we've had tremendous success both academically and in our other goal, which is to break down silos of race and class and opportunity in Baltimore.
And Wendy, there's a program that the Wallace Foundation has funded. Read about it a couple of years ago. They have things in Dallas and in Florida and in Pittsburgh, Rochester, New York, and they combine arts and, you know, sort of summer campy things with academic work during the summer. And these are actually run by school districts themselves. Public school districts take over the mantle of running a summer camp. What sorts of activities do you have the kids doing? And is it a part of your program that you're also incorporating arts and, you know, other things that people often, you know, sort of instinctively associate with summer camp?
We absolutely do. We have academics. They are, each curriculum is designed by each partnership. We ask that the kids be able to write a 5-paragraph essay, be ready for high school algebra and read above grade level, and to get into the top public schools in the city. We're very successful with that. But our kids also go on zip lines and do challenge courses and do stream studies and visit colleges and swim and ride horses and all of those other summer activities. And in fact, a number of our principals, Rhonda Raketa is on our board. Dr. Raketa is the principal of City Springs, one of the most challenged schools in terms of poverty in the city. And she has said to us that as much as it's important that the kids get the academics, the fact that the kids who live predominantly in Perkins homes get outside of that 6-block area, get to see grass, get to see the facilities.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the call, Wendy. That really, that's good to know about the middle grades partnership. Thanks so much for calling. And Sherena, the kids that you're taking to these places, to, you know, Europe and Costa Rica and Ghana, where do they live? Where are they concentrated in parts of the city, or are they spread out, or are they all from Baltimore City?
So about 99% of them are from Baltimore City. And when we looked at our data, I believe that some of them come from, like, I forgot the zip codes. It's like 21217 or 21215, which is the Park Heights area. And then we have about 40% of them that come from the East Baltimore, which is like the Collington area, you know, where like Fort Worthington is and so on and so forth. So, yeah. But I mean, they, you know, then we also had like one or two students that came from Owings Mills because they moved out there with their families and they still have the need. And so we really don't focus on whether the kids are, you know, in poverty or any of those types of things. We really try to treat all young people with the idea that they are capable, because I come from a background that's very similar to a lot of the youth here. And this is why I do what I do. So it's really important that we try not to just focus on certain concentrated areas, but we focus on what they're capable of doing. And we actually work with the parents. We actually interview the parents and work with the parents on how to set goals for the scholar, because it's not a normal program. So we work with them. So if they have any other social challenges, we try to connect them to resources and things like that. But we still push through. But yeah, they live.
But you are, that's an important dimension. You're making sure that the parents are bought into this.
Oh, they have to. You can't even do the program if you don't have some type of support. And I know that that might seem a little strange for Baltimore City, because that's not really the typical way, but it actually works way better for our results and for our outcomes. So, you know, we work with parents where they are. We don't ask them to have a certain income or anything. We don't even ask them about that. We don't ask them, how do you live and where do you live? What do you need? And how can we help your scholar be successful? So that's what we do. Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And it's really touching, too, that you call them scholars. That's really
yes.
great.
Yes.
We're out of time. I'm sorry to say we could talk about this for a much longer time, but I very much appreciate both of you coming by. Very good. And happy summer.
Thank
good to see you.
Thank
both.
You. Thank you.
Sherena Christmas is the executive director of Muse 360 Arts and New Generation Scholars. If you'd like to help support the scholars' trip to Ghana next month, come to our website, wypr.org/midday, and we'll have information about the email address and phone number that you need to make that happen. Dr. Sherry Parks, of course, joins us every month for Midday Culture Connections from the Maryland Institute College of Art. Her book is called Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, best-selling author Adam Gopnik joins me to discuss his new book, A Thousand Small Sanities, The Moral Adventure of Liberalism. It's about the history and ambition of liberalism. We want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared has been recently recognized by the Daily Meal. You can find menu and hours at joesquared.com. www.thebestofmusic.com. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great summer. Have a great day.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.